When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As promised, a special episode dedicated to the announcement of the 2020 Pulitzer Prizes and many things, really. We're not going to go through detail of the reporting and music and everything. We're going to stick with the letters ones, you know, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, too. We'll talk about a little bit, even though I scarcely imagine either of us have much to say about the poetry winners this and other year, but worth mentioning for sure. And Rebecca, you watched the live stream of the Pulitzer, which I want to hear about too. Do I have that right? Yeah.
Yeah, you do. It's the first time I've paid attention to the Pulitzer announcement live, I think, since we've done Book Riot.
Maybe I've got it wrong, but I think this might be the first time they actually live streamed it. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I don't know. There were a few years where they were getting announced on Twitter,
right,
and presumably in other venues at the same time, I think, but I would catch up later. Like, this has never been something that I've had on my calendar as like at 3 o'clock on this day, I need to see right as it's announced who is winning. But I watched the live stream yesterday. Yep.
It's funny to think of the format of the three major literary awards that we pay attention to, would even dedicate a whole show to, maybe like the National Book Award, this, and the Nobel Prize, because each of them have this announcement strategy that varies so wildly. So this one historically has been a tweet and a press release, right? Mm-hmm. This year it was a live stream. The Nobel Prize is like some Swedish dude comes out from behind a gold door to a gaggle of reporters and says a few words that need to be translated and then steps back in. Like kind of like Willy Wonka coming out of the factory and then walking back in. And the National Book Award has designs on being like the Oscars for books. And so it goes completely the other direction. And so I feel like none of them are the right thing. Not that I know what the right thing, but none of these feel like an event. Like, I don't even know what you would do to make sense, but all of them feel wrong.
Yeah, I feel like the National Book Award gets it the closest, like, because there's at least some pomp and circumstance. Like, this is, to win a major book award is a big deal. It's like one of the highest accomplishments, if not the highest accomplishment in your field. And it feels like for whatever a person's field is, that moment of getting recognition by your peers or the critics or, you know, your greater artistic community should come with some confetti throwing. So, like, I haven't been to the National Book Awards, but it is a big dinner. I think it's like the Golden Globes equivalent, you know, like there's a big dinner,
round tables and booze,
there's a host, round tables and booze, it's a whole thing. Like, just announcing it on Twitter and a press release, it seems just too anticlimactic. I do love the weirdness of the Nobel, so that one's fine with me, but I feel like the Pulitzers, like, they could, you know, do some trumpeting, drop some balloons, and so it was interesting that at least this year there was like a live thing you could tune into to see. And you know, I guess they couldn't do like the full live thing without spoiling who the winners were going to be for them. But it was fun to watch, like, one, like Colson Whitehead, who won the Pulitzer for fiction, followed up the announcement by Instagramming a photo of himself like out on the street in New York wearing a mask and a Misfits t-shirt.
That's very
like, oh,
Colson
cool.
Whitehead.
There he is. Yep. Like, yep. You know, it really is. And like, maybe, you know, they could have zoomed him in or had everyone on screen or something. Yeah, it was interesting. And I think if I had to pick, I would go with the National Book Awards format, just because it's an actual thing that occurs.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's do a sponsor real quick. Then we'll actually get into who won what when we come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her soul family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young Duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young Duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
As Rebecca said, the top line is, well, for us, for our purposes, that Colson White had won his second Pulitzer. The first was for Underground Railroad, but this one for the Nickel Boys. As I'm not sure that we predicted this as so much as hoped for it.
Yeah.
But maybe I predicted it. I don't know. But I'm taking credit for knowing things. I'm putting a pile of knowing things chips into my account.
Yeah,
about this. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I was not pulling for anything else. And I think the place that I had landed was there were other great novels last year. I could have gotten behind this one or On Earth Were Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong winning.
Right.
But I didn't find myself like really hoping for any others. I think it would have been hard to understand this being awarded to anything but those two novels from last year, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. I mean, I haven't talked much about Ben Lerner on this show for reasons I'll get into in a minute, but The Topeka School was one of the finalists for fiction, and then Ann Patchett's The Dutch House, which I used to be more of an Ann Patchett person than I am these days. This book sold very well, very well regarded, narrated by Tom Hanks because of Twitter internet friendship, which we talked about before. Interesting group of finalists. I mean, of note, the Pulitzer hasn't been awarded to a woman since 2014, which isn't great.
Nope.
On the other hand, well, there is no really other hand for the Pulitzer, but the wider awarding world has been much more egalitarian in that regard. So the Pulitzer kind of gets lost in that. I don't know if we're doing, I'm not sure where we are right now with sort of accounting for inclusion in that way. Is it an individual award situation across the board? The National Book Award has been given to a woman, I think, the last 4 years in a row. So do we throw it in with there? Does it? I don't know. It's something that's worth noting in this particular case. Did you read either The Topeka School or Dutch House?
I didn't. The Topeka School just didn't quite make it on my radar. I'm interested now, though, that I've been reading about it this morning. And The Dutch House is, I think, one of those also where, like, I used to be a bigger Ann Patchett fan, and I just sort of stopped paying attention. And then I heard that The Dutch House was like a rich people problems novel. And I do love a rich people problems novel, and I will probably read that at some point. But I was surprised to see that make it into
Me too.
Discussion of presumably like the top three best or most important books of the year.
Let's talk about the Nickel Boys for a minute. It's shorter than it's a pretty short book, which is interesting. It's not only short, but a smaller format than you get from a lot of hardcovers these days. It came out pretty quick after the Underground Railroad for the way literary novels tend to work. And Whitehead himself, he tends to be pretty regular, but it did come out like just think 2 years after Underground Railroad. Maybe I have this on backward. It's the story.
No,
that's right. It's historical fiction, and it's non-fabulist or magical realism like the Underground Railroad. It takes real accounts, a real story of this this correctional facility slash jail slash school, presented in different ways in the novel, depending on who's talking about it, where the main character is wrongly sent to it, you know, for something he didn't do, a young black man, in the 50s, I think it is. I actually don't have the time right.
I think it's the, I Googled, it's the 60s. In Tallahassee, Florida. So you're in Tallahassee. Jim Crow.
Yeah, Jim Crow, Florida. And his experience and the other nickel boys, the titular nickel boys, these kids, young men, boys, you know, right on that cusp where they could be boys, could be men. They get punished like men, but also then called boy, you know, the classic double standard there. And it's powerful. It's horrifying. It's very spare. It doesn't do the thing Whitehead has been doing of late of crossing, mixing genres. Maybe touches horror a little bit. Like there's this room that they get sent to for punishment that has a horror film quality to it. But outside of that, it's pretty straight historical fiction in a way we haven't really seen him do since ever. To my, you know, I'm trying to run through the Whitehead backlist. I guess maybe Sag Harbor, which is historical fiction about a black vacation community in Long Island. I guess that would be the most, that would be his other historical fiction, which is completely different, though. Also fascinating. I thought the book was a real achievement of letting the story speak for itself. I think he realized maybe that he didn't need to put any zombie on it, you know, for lack of a better term, and do the story as best he could. And a continuing exploration of how many clubs are in Whitehead's bag, I think, is one thing I took from the Nickel Boys. What was your sense of it?
Much the same as that. It is so much smaller, both in like length and the size of the book, as you were saying. I think it's deceptively small in that sense that like I picked it up. I remember on a, I think like a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, I was like, let me see what this new Colson Whitehead is about. And I sat there for hours until I was done, just like, well, this is my life today. I'm reading this book. It's incredible. And I think he was absolutely right. And just to echo you in, it's much more restrained. It's quieter. There's like no bells and whistles here, because a story like this doesn't need bells and whistles. And not only that, it wouldn't benefit from them.
Yeah.
And I don't think so much that it ventures into a horror as it just shines a light by telling it. He just tells it as it is for these characters, based on this real place that like it's torture. They go into this room and they are tortured, or they're killed and, you know, buried in a field in the back of the property. And spoilers abound. Sorry for the Nickel Boys now that we're here.
There's a story of these, especially a couple of characters that we follow that we won't touch what actually happens to them in particular. I think we're not really beyond the bounds of like a book review at this point.
Like it's a real place that you can Google and find out what they did there. But it's interesting, I think, that you were feeling that horror genre capacity, because like to my mind, a horror book has like some fantastic elements to it. Like it's the inverse of a fantasy or a daydream. It's like it's a nightmare, where you might be inventing things, and there's nothing invented here. It's all drawn from reality and drawn from horrific truth, and that just letting it stand by itself, I think, is incredibly powerful. And to have done this, right, it was 2017 when he won for the Underground Railroad, and to have done this 2 years later is
amazing.
I don't even know how to guess about what happens next in Colson Whitehead's literary career. Like,
I don't know. It feels like he could do anything.
I
guess the thing we haven't seen that's possible, like in the realm of possibility, and this maybe bridges into the Ben Lerner for a minute, is... or like some of our other favorites, like the Marilyn Robinson, is like a multi-novel arc, like a multi-novel sort of world of some kind or a place. That's not something we've seen him do that he could. Does he want to venture into the realm of sort of high fantasy, something like that? He's done speculative fiction, but he hasn't done high fantasy or more future, like a future forward science fiction sort of thing. He tends to look backward in the speculative fiction realm, except for Zone One, which is sort of present day you know, alternate present more than anything. It's so hard to say. It is interesting to see him turn towards unknown, underknown historical fiction, much like Morrison did with Beloved when he wrote about the book, The Underground Railroad, is about slavery. The fantastical element, I think, to some degree, is a way of reframing the story in a way that looks at it differently to get us out of our familiar understanding, our sort of ready-made understanding of, like, this, you know, slavery was this or was like this. And so, like, Water Dancer is doing a similar thing of, like, right, using a fantastical element to look at it anew. But if you're looking at something for the first time, or you understand that most people reading the book are going to be reading it for the first time, you just sort of, just the facts, ma'am, does a lot, you know, with his considerable stylistic gifts on top of it, of course. But I don't think you need to go and do anything really more complicated than tell the truth and tell it straight as much as you can, imbue it with humanity. And it worked. I could see him continuing in that vein. I can see how doing it once, if you read a little bit about what he said about it, it seems to him that he was very personally affected by learning this story. And, you know, a lot of it wanting to tell the story of these Nickel Boys. Like, these are kids and young men that lived and died and were killed and buried and erased. And this moment of it's a kind of story of resurrection in a way, a literary resurrection, to bring the story to light so that, you know, dummies like me are thinking about it and talking about it. So it has a sociological element that transcends, I think, just writing a novel about a thing that you can, you know, sell books about and get people interested in. So I wonder if that might continue as well.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting angle for it, because this is the kind of story that, like, if you hear the broad strokes of it, there's a school in the South. It's a, you know, like, reformatory. Mm-hmm. Young Black men are sent there. They're tortured and punished. And some of them are sent there wrongfully from having not done anything. You know, it's impossible to get out, basically. Nobody who's familiar with American history would doubt that these places existed.
No.
You know, like, it's very believable that many of these places existed, but telling a particular story that's grounded in, not just grounded in reality, but in all of the, like, the rich detail that he creates and the interior experience of these characters drawn from real life accounts of people who lived there does make it real in a new way. And I think your point about bringing magical realism to the Underground Railroad, you're right, was intended to do the same thing, that's a story we already are familiar with. We know about slavery. We know about the Underground Railroad. How do you make it feel new, or how do you sort of wake people back up to it?
Right. Yep.
And that's by shaking it up and bringing something unexpected. Like, this is unexpected. There's some magic here. You actually don't know what's about to happen. You think you do, but you don't know. And for something like this, it's a story that we didn't know. There's nothing, I think, surprising about what happens in this place. It's disappointingly believable and predictable. And, you know, probably dozens, if not hundreds, of other institutions like this existed. But like, this here, he's saying, here is what happened to this one person in this one place.
Right.
And it lets you imagine the experiences of the hundreds or thousands of other young men that experienced it as well.
Yeah. So, again, I'm a huge fan. You know, both you and I have said in a previous show that he's our draft pick, number one overall draft pick for, if there is a mantle for the greatest living American novels, if that's something anyone cares about, I'd throw my stock behind Whitehead. And, you know, it's hard even now to, I guess, put him in the context of American literary history, because he's still relatively young. I mean, that's another thing. He's not in his 70s. He's got 6, 8, 10 more novels in him. So to reach the mountaintop twice in the form of a Pulitzer, which is really the American, you know, stamp of approval from the literary community, where do you go from here? How do you spend that capital, I think, is an interesting question. Like, does he think about it in those terms at all? I don't know where the production is on this, especially in the moment we are in, where Barry Jenkins is supposedly or was going to adapt the Underground Railroad into a multi-part series, which I think would be fascinating. Whitehead himself doesn't seem interested in, say, doing the Ta-Nehisi Coates thing of writing Black Panther or getting into TV or movies or something else like that. I could certainly understand if he wanted to. Selfishly, I hope he doesn't.
Same.
I think if you're the, I think for me, I want white. He's the. I don't know. There's a book I look forward more. I mean, even Jack aside, the Marilyn Robinson, I joke about that. But if you ask me to say if I get one new novel by someone, I'm still picking Whitehead, even knowing what the thing is. So I want that to be the thing. Like, if you're the best at making the thing, keep making that thing. Though I can understand now that maybe there are new worlds to explore and conquer and new mediums that he might explore. But boy, the achievement is such that I hope he continues to ply his trade in the way that I want, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, I totally agree. Yeah. Like, he does something different with every novel, yeah, and it's unexpected and unpredictable. And like, we're sitting here being like, what's it going to be next? And you could tell me literally anything and I'd be like, okay, I believe you that Colson Whitehead is doing that and doing it well. Mm-hmm. And that he is so young still and relatively early in his career is so promising. And also, like, there's plenty time if
plenty
he wants
time.
To write
plenty time.
You know,
yeah,
like, if he wants to take his time, take as much time as you need, Colson Whitehead, to write more novels, and maybe he does want to explore other forms of pop culture, other media, like, I would be interested in that as well. I think he is such an interesting mind. But to think about the historical context of this, he's one of only four people to have won the Pulitzer for fiction twice. The other three are Booth Tarkington, William Faulkner, and John Updike. And so of those three, like, I don't hear anybody talk about Booth Tarkington ever. I don't know anything about Booth Tarkington.
That magnificent Ambersons isn't on your top of your TBR? I mean, it's
super
fine,
not.
Whatever.
Yeah. but Faulkner and Updike, those names are still, you know, very present in how we talk about the canon. Yeah. Been a while since those guys had books out. I think that we're seeing Whitehead take his place as a novelist we're going to be talking about for generations, and thinking about the Underground Railroad, like, to think about the Underground Railroad and the Nickel Boys as still maybe the beginning of someone's career. Like, these are pinnacle kinds of works.
Yeah.
There are writers who never reach these heights. Like, if this is the best it gets for Colson Whitehead, that's a huge accomplishment, but that it feels like there's still room for so much more. Mm-hmm. I think it's just really incredible. And selfishly, as a reader, I want that. Also, I want to see what else he's going to do.
It's interesting that it's to look at the antecedents for double wins, the Updike, the Faulkner, the Ambersons, and then even in the tradition out of which, you know, we and others place Whitehead too, of Black literature in America, the Ellisons, the Morrisons. What stands out to me is Colson Whitehead's heterogeneity of form within. Like, we both love Morrison, but you kind of knew the air, like, what the air would feel like in a Morrison novel.
Yeah, you kind of know what the Marilyn Robinson is going to feel like.
You know what the air is going to feel like in an Updike novel. You know what the air is going to feel like in a Faulkner novel. And I'll go out on my, and I'll do my thing of, like, I know what the air feels like in a Booth Tarkington novel. Mm. Whereas with Whitehead, the only constant is a certain amount of surprise and delight of not knowing what the book is going to be about. You walk through a zone one's like the zombie novel, the intuitionist. I mean, you only need to look at the first novel and be like, it's an alternate history where elevator repair is like a religion / cult / spiritual practice.
Yeah.
Like, that's where we started.
Right.
And then John Henry Days is this mythological sort of call and response between the actual John Henry and these PR flacks. Ajax Hides the Hurt is about this town that basically sells its name of the town to be, like, they're all so strange and different. Like, each on their own are not that strange, I guess. Like, they're different and interesting, but they're not, like, bizarre. It's not like it's not like reading Naked Lunch or something like that.
Right.
But taken together, the spectrum is kind of mesmerizingly dizzying, which I can't really say about too many authors, frankly.
Yeah,
I really can't.
I think that for most people, and so that extends to artists and writers, groundlessness can be scary. And Colson Whitehead finds a way to make groundlessness appealing and delightful. And even when it's scary, you're like really glad to be there and to not know what the ground is that you're standing on because it's so interesting.
Yeah.
And he's just so masterful. Like, I think as a reader, I always feel like I'm in great hands with him, that if I don't know what's happening and I don't know where we're going, it's okay, because like we're going to get somewhere that's worth being. And the process will have been fascinating. And that's just, it takes so much guts. Like, there's real literary courage to tell these kinds of stories and to be as varied and unpredictable and like, and weird, just straight up weird. Like, the concept behind The Intuitionist is weird. And a lot of his work goes in that direction, but it's not performatively weird. It's like, this is weird. This is weird, but you're about to believe it.
Yeah, there's a certain, there's a version of him, of these books, and they exist out there, where weirdness is thought of as an end in itself. Like, there's like the ironical, like the caricature of the ironical hipster of like 15 years ago, of just like liking weird stuff because it's weird.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. That's not what he does. The strangeness is a reframing and disorientation that has the arrow points somewhere. It has a goal and a purpose outside of a kind of nihilistic reveling in meaninglessness, right? Which is sort of the ironical take of liking things that are bad, for example. And in one reason a reading pathway for Whitehead is so hard is there's no direction necessarily. There's no, you know, if you, it's more like, what do you like? Do you like a detective story? Do you like zombie novels? Do you like historical fiction? Do you like, you know, memoirs or coming of age, you know, that's Sag Harbor. Do you like satire? And I could point you to any of those books, but there's no sequence where this leads to this leads to this. There is, it's a mountain range without having a peak at this point. Maybe Underground Railroad, but maybe not. Maybe not at this
point. Yeah. I also think it doesn't matter what you like with him. Like, this is not a case of, okay, he's not one of those writers where it's like, okay, well, you like speculative fiction, so you should start with Zone One. Like, maybe you should start with Zone One, but that shouldn't be the only Colson Whitehead you read. And by the time you're done with it, you won't want it to be. It's like, all right, you can do this. What else do you have? And I feel like he's one of those writers that makes readers willing to go wherever he wants to go.
Yeah. It's like if your favorite restaurant, like the best restaurant you've ever been to, was like different every time you went in. Like, it had different cuisine. Like, you knew it was going to be good. And even if you didn't think you're going to like the thing, you trusted the chef and the staff and the line cooks to do something great. You know, if you like, I mean, frankly, this is one of those things I say. If you like literary fiction, and let's make no mistake, that's the meta genre he's within, right? Like, yes, if there's a genre to all of them, it's literary fiction that pushes boundaries to some. But if you like it at all, there's something to be found in almost, I think you'll find at least something in every book. And I have my favorites and ones I didn't like as well, but all of them were worth unwrapping and spending some time in. No major quote unquote mistakes. The stakes are different in various different ones, but an amazing achievement. And I'm always glad to get the chance to talk about Whitehead as we're sort of experiencing here. And so excited to see what's next. But I also think it'd be all right if he never won another Pulitzer. He's got two, you know, like, you know, we could spread it around a little bit. We've talked about that in these things with literary fiction before. I guess that takes me, let's do another sponsor break and then we'll come back and talk about the rest of fiction and run through the other ones as well.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. And let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be, right? Right, girl, like we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
I haven't talked about Ben Lerner on the show. I don't think you and I have ever talked on Ben Lerner. And the reason for this is I think I'm too I love Ben Lerner. Going back to leaving at Choa Station from Coffee House Press, I think in 2011. Look, I'm going to describe to you Ben Lerner himself and his literary career, and you'll understand why I can't talk about it objectively. He graduated from Topeka High. I'm from Lawrence, Kansas. So Topeka High is about 15 mm-hmm. miles from where I grew up in 1997. He's 1 year younger than I am. His mom is a psychiatrist, was a psychiatrist, maybe still practicing at Menninger's. My dad is a doctor in Lawrence. Both of us, like, he's much more accomplished than I am. I'm like, not even putting myself in the same category, except I was the same kind of kid growing up in the same kind of place as Ben Lerner was. And that's what he writes about. He writes about being a nerdy kid in the 90s in Kansas with vaguely literary aspirations. I can't talk about this, Rebecca. I don't know what to say to someone about this. Like, is it written for me? It's experimental and it's heartfelt, and I love all the books. I think the Topeka School is a wonder. I'm not sure I would recommend it to anybody else because it's like recommending my own clothes to someone else. It's like, now these are my clothes. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's great. It's amazing. So I don't even know what to say. I'm so glad to see it recognized here. And he's been recognized in other places. But this, I think, he won a MacArthur in 2015. But like a Pulitzer Prize finalist, I guess, makes me say, oh, other people like the clothes that I like. And I know people, and I know in literary circles, people have been on the Ben Lerner train like for a while now. But this is the first one that's really, I guess the 29, he won the LA Book Times Prize for Topeka School. And he was a poet for a while. He lives in Brooklyn. I mean, come on, man. Like, I don't know what else to say about this.
You're feeling a little seen.
Yeah. And I think the books are wonderful. I think the Topeka School is the best of the three major. So it's Leaving Choa Station, 1014, and Topeka School. And they're all kind of about people like Ben Lerner, but also not. So they're autofiction into that sense. Stylistically, it's very interesting, experimental. He's interested in language. He's interested in ideas. I think the closest analog I can think of that people might know is maybe Don DeLillo's White Noise, where it's realistic, but also thinking about ideas, and there's a big idea. And the big idea in Topeka School is this idea of the spread, whereas in White Noise, it was sort of the cloud. And what Lerner is writing about in the 90s is kind of what DeLillo is writing about in the 80s for their own times. Like Pesto's Quiche of the 80s is like, as they said in When Harry Met Sally, like the spread is the cloud of the 90s for Ben Lerner. I think it's really fantastic. I'd be fascinated for other people out there who have read this that didn't grow up basically in the novels to see what their experience was like. Maybe you don't need it. I'd be fascinated. Maybe this could be one of our big books of the year. I would love to talk about it. I don't want to inflict it on anybody else, but maybe this gives me enough authorization to say, all right, finals for the Pulitzer. It ain't just sort of my particular brand of whiskey we're talking about here.
I think it's not. Liberty was floating on our contributor Slack yesterday before the announcement that she thought we were going to hear Ben Lerner's name mentioned.
Oh, and
Liberty,
I missed that. Yeah.
Yeah. And she grew up in Maine.
Right.
A pretty different experience from yours in many ways and from Ben Lerner's in many ways. I'm interested. I think that what you're talking about is actually really important because it for me hangs a lantern on that, like, we're never objective about the ways that we interact with art, but we sometimes think that we are until you bump into something that's so close that you have to acknowledge the subjectivity of it. I want to read this. It sounds great. I like the 90s, and I was
it's fascinating. So Lerner himself, just to do some biography, because maybe people haven't heard the name before, he was the national forensics champion at Topeka High, and he writes about, and concurrently there was, this is really nerdy, but in forensics and debate, there was sort of a development in the tactics for forensics and debate that grew up, I think it was in the 90s too, I trust the book more than me, I'm maybe getting this confused, of kind of an asymmetric warfare where, you know, in debate and for forensics, there's extemporaneous speaking and you're trying to make points and win arguments. But there became sort of an asymmetric warfare where it became a successful tactic just to sort of like overwhelm someone with volume of words and non sequiturs so they really couldn't respond. Mm-hmm. It's sort of strange. And that becomes a metaphor for abundance and excess and meaninglessness in the Topeka school. Because it doesn't mean anything and yet it wins.
Oh boy.
And I feel like those of us who, and it's not about the internet, which is also interesting. Like my next, when we talk about Whitehead, what's next for him? I really want Lerner to turn to the internet because we haven't gotten there yet. And I'd be fascinating to know how he would take on the internet because it's this 90s, there's a 90s moment that feels very real to me because I lived it, but it was also before the internet, which almost takes this kernel of an idea and it goes supernova, or does he think it does something else? I'd love to read it. What is, but this idea of the spread I find so compelling. And applicable in a lot of different ways. And I haven't seen theorized in quite this way, but I've been out of academia for a while. Also, the other thing to say that I don't know if I put a point on it, is he started out as a poet, a multi-award winning poet. And so the language is, you know, razor sharp barbs in your eyeballs kind of stuff, which almost to me makes the DeLillo comparison unfair to Lerner, because I think he's a much more inventive stylist than DeLillo ever was. So there's that piece of it as well.
Man, I've gone back and forth like 10 times in the last 8 minutes about whether I should read this book or not, because I had a boyfriend in 1999 who had that exact approach to forensics and life. Overwhelming.
Maybe too soon. Maybe
with all the things. Like, I don't know. I've had 20 years.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know. It's also interesting. Again, we've talked about this on the show, the decentering. A long overdue decentering of white male experience, which is overdue and is part of the conversation, but shouldn't be, you know, the only conversation. But again, it's my time, but I find his approach of centering his own experience without like centering his worldview to be an interesting navigation of a responsive mode to maybe an appropriate way rather than an inappropriate way of understanding your experience as being meaningful without being the experience or the primary one. And that specificity, I think, lends itself to it. You know, he didn't grow up on the East. I mean, I think there's something too that he didn't grow up going to an elite boarding school outside of New York or something like that. I mean, from my own experiences too, there is a sort of marginalization of growing up in Kansas of someone who wants to do something around books. Like you felt to be at the margin already. You're an outsider looking in that regard, even if, you know, your own identity was triumphant and wildly privileged. But even that experience of like trying to figure out how to engage with the idea of art itself is very much at stake in the Topeka school. Like the protagonist's sort of biggest fear is he has this desire to be transformed by experiencing art and yet can't. And like his biggest fear is that he does not have that thing that would let art be transcendent to him.
Oh right? Man. Ouch.
It's really great. I think it's really great. I'd be curious to hear. I haven't read too much about it from other people because I didn't want to hear from other people, frankly.
Just hold on to it. It's okay. Let it be.
Yeah. Let it be. So you can hear my, you can hear maybe why I haven't talked about it too much at this point, but I'm going to use the moment now to express my great admiration for Ben Lerner's
yeah.
work.
And also, like, you can decide that we never talk about it again. Maybe this is it, and you just need to hold Ben Lerner
yeah,
close.
It's fine.
And that's okay.
Look, I'm going to be okay. Don't worry about me. It's if anyone else is interested in doing it, in talking about it some other time. I mean, it's a cycle. Again, it's hard to say. And I haven't read the first one for so long that I would like to read them all again at one piece. But I think if we ever wanted to talk about them, maybe talking about them all three at the same time might be interesting. Because I think they do form a through line that's worth thinking. But anyway, take that out there, folks listening, for what you will. You know, I'm not sure what else to say about it. I'm not sure what to say about the Dutch House. I've kind of used my enthusiasm up on the first two. People like it. It seemed to sell well. Is there anything? What else do we want to say about it?
I haven't read it yet. Like, I'm reading, you know, I've been reading the descriptions and checking back on reviews. And, like, it's a multi-generational story about a family and wealth. And, like, this sounds on paper like something that I should love. I wonder if I used my coin for that type of story.
Yes, that's the most, a great, I feel the same.
Like The Most Fun We Ever Had by Claire Lombardo, which was a great big novel about a complicated family that I absolutely adored last year, like 500 some odd pages. And I really enjoyed every one of them. I don't know. I just have a hard time getting my feathers ruffled about Ann Patchett. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd be happy to be talked out of that if listeners want to make a case here. I think the show, the future show that I'm putting together in my mind is like runners up for the big awards, and I could talk myself into like reading. I'm going to read the Ben Lerner. It's like I could read the Ben Lerner and something from the National Book Awards shortlist that didn't win and, you know, one of the Booker ones or something maybe. Honestly, and this is now we're just like in idiosyncratic complaints, but this is our podcast. The title, not the title, the title and the cover really put me off the Ann Patchett because I would have guessed that it was set in like the 1800s based on this like old painting and it's called the Dutch House. Like what is this about? What are these people? I don't know.
Fair. Yeah. I think you're expressing a little bit differently, but I'm in the same vein of. Not for me. I mean, I'm not opposed to it. Like if I was in a book group and they decided to read it, I wouldn't throw up any roadblocks, but I wouldn't advocate. You know, I'm not going to choose it over some other things on my list at this point, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I think I don't have any objection to it. I'm needing right now for fiction to like kind of grab me by the throat if I'm going to pay attention to fiction. And I don't. Maybe grab me by the throat might even be strong, but like I really need fiction with teeth, and my experience of Ann Patchett is not that toothy.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, especially comparing it to something like the Nickel Boys or Topeka School, my sense of Patchett is a certain edgelessness now, and both Topeka School and Nickel Boys have an edge that if I'm looking for that kind of reading experience, that's what I want.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good.
If I'm looking for art reading, I want a little edge. If I'm not looking for art reading, I want something else. And at Patchett, it falls into sort of a demilitarized zone between those two for me right now.
Yeah, I've never been sad about an Ann Patchett book that I've read. But I've never like woken up and been like, the thing I need to do today is read Ann Patchett.
Yeah, which is probably one reason she sells very well. And that's no shade. No, I'm serious.
No, I think you're right.
Where do you want to go for? I mean, we should go nonfiction. Do we have anything to say about the other letters awards rather than running through them? I don't have much of a. I haven't read any of them. I've heard of a few of them. I don't know that any. Pulitzer in nonfiction tends not to be something I'll pick up. I'll go pick up because of. So I don't know. Where do you want to go?
The introduction to the live stream, I think, and before as they got into the journalism awards, for me was the most interesting part of it.
Tell me
because
about it.
Usually my experience of the Pulitzers is like the day after they're awarded, I go to the Pulitzer website and read about who the winners are. And I scroll past all of the reporting to see fiction, nonfiction, and maybe poetry. And the watching the intro, like the sort of introductory speech to it and the text of that discussion brought back to me like really how much these awards are about journalism.
Yeah,
and
right.
Like the arts awards are just sort of like tacked on, but they, you know, specifically talked about, I can't remember the woman's name, I should have written it down, who's the chair of the Pulitzers. these are direct quotes, in difficult times, the Pulitzers may be more important than ever. Journalism never stops, and that they are specifically this year awarding journalism in the context, like the societal context of coordinated efforts to undermine our free press. Like, Pulitzer came out with some guns blazing in that talk, shining a specific light onto not just the work that they were awarding, but I think giving us some insight into why they chose the finalists and the winners that they chose for the kinds of work that were done. And it's sort of ranging, but lots of stuff related to overuse and abuse of authority, stuff relating to exposing predatory issues in, you know, giant industries, extreme temperatures and climate science reporting was done. And seeing all of that, it was like, wow, this is like, there, 2020, 2019, 2020 have been big. There are a lot of things going on in the world, and journalists are doing a ton of work, really important, big work. And that brought it home to me. Also, just interestingly, there were screenshots at the very beginning of the Zoom calls where the finalists were being deliberated. And some of those were dated like May 1st and 2nd. And it was just interesting to me that up until like the 2nd of May, 2 days before these were awarded, they were still having calls and deliberating it. I don't know anything about any of the nonfiction winners or the poetry category. No. But I did note a lovely phrase that I will share with you about the winning book was Benjamin Moser's book about Susan Sontag. And it was described as capturing her volatile enthusiasms, which
that's nice,
right?
That's nice. I had that book on my someday, maybe. I like a literary biography. I realized I was just mistaken. I did read one of the finalists in biography, Parisian Lives, Samuel Beckett, Simone de Beauvoir, and Me, by Deirdre Baer. I think that's how you say the name, Bair, which is her memoir of being around that cadre of people. Kind of like, it's not unlike tonally and stylistically, it's much different. But in terms of subject matter, it's kind of like Movable Feast by Hemingway, about being in this particular moment in Paris with literary stars and kind of, the nerdiest possible celebrity, you know, gossipy kind of stuff. Like, you know, this is what it was like to be in this particular moment in time. I thought it was really fun. I thought it was really interesting and good, and a boots on the ground account there. Again, not one I'd recommend to most people, you know, unless you like literary history in this kind of book, but it was really good. So the other finalist for biography was our man Richard Holbrooke in The End of the American Century. There's usually a big political biography that I couldn't find less interesting. Like, I'll read a New Yorker profile of someone, but I'm not going to spend 600 pages reading about bureaucrats from the 70s. It's just not going to happen. History, Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution America by W. Caleb McDaniel. About reparations, but told through the story of one particular woman who survived a kidnapping and re-enslavement and eventually went on to sue the people that kidnapped her. I'm sure that sounds really interesting as well. Also, Race for Profit was a finalist, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership. And then The End of Myth, From Frontier to the Border Wall and the Mind of America, is a finalist for history. That got moved to be a co-winner in general nonfiction, interestingly, by the board. The Pulitzer, I don't know what goes on, because the board moves things around and the jury moves things around, and it's always unclear to me who's happy with what was given out. But in general nonfiction, The End of the Myth was one of the winners, and the other one was The Undying, which has one of the grimmer subtitles you're ever going to hear. Here it is. The Undying, : pain, vulnerability, mortality, medicine, art, time, dreams, data, exhaustion, cancer, and care, by Ann Boyer.
The way that the chairwoman spoke about it when she was announcing this award, though, I was like, oh, I'm going to read that.
Really? Here's the description. An elegant and unforgettable narrative about the brutality of illness and the capitalism of cancer care in America. I'm sure a very important work. Sounds like a tough hang.
It does, but you know, The Emperor of All Maladies also sounds like a tough hang and is wonderful.
Yeah, but Sure. I'm not going to try to yuck anybody's yum. I'm saying for me, I already read The Emperor of Maladies. Just for me. Finalist, Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life by Louise Aronson, and Solitary by Albert Woodfox with Leslie George. The general nonfiction and history categories, let's just say it, kind of a bummer. They're usually bummer topics. Important works, but, you know, not a lot of stories of triumph and fun or something like that. Like solitary confinement, getting old, cancer care, border walls. Journalism is serious and important work. And these are serious, important books.
Yeah,
fun it is, like, is not, I don't think bingo, fun though. Is on yeah. the list of things they're looking yeah. for, which is fine. Yeah. That's fine.
It is
That's
fine. In 10 years, one of these is going to be about the COVID pandemic.
Oh, I mean, fascinating to see how none of this stuff is about it. Of course it's not, because it's from 2019. But how many years of COVID-related stories are we going to get? I mean, we're going to get decades of stories, right? Like, that's just what's going to happen. In the poetry, The Tradition by Jericho Brown, a collection of masterful lyrics that combine delicacy with historical urgency and their loving evocation of bodies vulnerable to hostility and violence. Finalist there, Dunce by Mary Ruefle, Ruefle, and Only As the Day is Long, New and Selected Poems by Dorian Laux, from Norton. Drama, boy, now we're really getting out of my wheelhouse. The Strange Loop by Michael R. Jackson, and one, and then finalists were Heroes of the Fourth Turning by William Arbery, and Soft Power by David Henry Hwang and Janine Tesori. Always fascinating to see. The drama one is always interesting just to read the description, because I have a hard time imagining dramas. This one's described as a metafictional musical that tracks the creative process of an artist transforming issues of identity, race, and sexuality that once pushed him to the margins of the cultural mainstream into a meditation on universal human feats and insecurities. A metafictional musical. There we go. What else do you want to say? Anything? We did our piece. We talked about the things we knew something about and didn't say things about things we didn't.
Yeah, they also did a special citation for Ida B. Wells for, I'll just read the quote, for her outstanding and courageous reporting on the horrific and vicious violence against African Americans during the era of lynching. The citation comes with a bequest by the Pulitzer Prize Board of at least $50,000 in support of her mission, and recipients will be announced at a later date. So that was cool. I haven't seen the Pulitzer do something like that. I don't know if it has in the past, but really nice to see that recognition of Ida B. Wells's work, and also tied back into my thinking of, like, right, this is, the Pulitzer is grounded in, like, what's happening in the world in a meaningful and different way, I think, than, like, the National Book Awards or some of those other book prizes whose names I am forgetting right now.
Right. But, well, you know, we could go through the National Book Critics Circle Award.
That, like, because it's so grounded in journalism and reporting, the kinds of books that show up on this list are, I think, often different than what we get on other big book of the year lists. And the Nickel Boys sort of transcends all those categories because it's not, you know, current events, but deeply tied to American history and society in a way that we'll never be able to stop talking about, and we shouldn't be. That was interesting to see the Ida B. Wells piece come in as well. That was cool.
Yeah, I mean, your point is well taken that, like, for journalism, this is the Oscars and the Grammys and everything rolled into one. I guess, like, the second most prestigious award in journalism is, like, a Peabody, and then name the one after that everyone hears about. And we do get the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize and the Nobel Prize in letters, right? In fiction and so on and so forth. Like, it makes sense that this is the, you know, this is the ring of honor among ring of honors for journalism as a field. That's our show. We'll be back. Well, you'll listen to us talk about news next. And then I finished Fried Green Tomatoes, the book, last night. And I'm going to watch the movie tomorrow. Where are you?
I'm about halfway through the book. I'm going to watch the movie this weekend.
Okay. Any initial non-spoilery thoughts about the book so far?
You know, fiction set in the South in the 20s that was written in the 80s is a tough hang in some ways, but also a fun read. But yeah. there are some very cringy parts that don't age well.
Some parts have aged beautifully, some parts have not.
Yeah. And then there are parts I'm finding, I don't want to spoil it all for the show, but there are parts that I'm finding imagining, like, if she were to write this book today, how would these characters be presented? Yeah. And it's really interesting to think about cultural change that way.
Yeah, I found the reading experience provocative in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Good and some of them not so good, but
yeah,
very
I think that's a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been an interesting one. I'm glad that we're doing it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Rebecca, we'll talk to you later. You can email us at podcast@bookriot.com. You can also find show notes for this and all back episodes of the Book Riot podcast at bookriot.com/listen. If you happen to, still a little short on recommendation requests, to be honest with you, shoot them to us at podcast@bookriot.com. We'll get to them as we can. Thanks, Rebecca. Talk to you.
Thank you.
After I stop gushing to myself in the mirror about Ben Lerner here in a minute. I've got a few more minutes. I got to get out about that.
You know, we got to roll around in the good things we can find right now.
Well said.